I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Gene Barman joins me again, the distinguished historian and author of more than a dozen books of B.C. and Canadian history, recently published Invisible Generations Living Between Indigenous and White in the Fraser Valley. We talked last week about this book, which is a story of a family, three generations of mixed Indigenous and white descent. At the book's heart is Irene Kelleher, a woman born in British Columbia's Fraser Valley, whose European grandfathers had families with Indigenous women. It turns out it wasn't at all uncommon, though it was a story not readily shared. Kelleher, who lived to be 103 years old when she died in 2004, had meticulously preserved her family's story through journals and histories. There are even tapes of interviews that Ember Orchard of the CBC had done with Kelleher's parents in the 1960s. So the story goes back 150 years or so and captures what life was like in the Fraser Valley in three different centuries. I'll get Jean to tell us about how she got to know Kelleher in the 1990s and about the relationship she had with her identity, that being of mixed race, meant at times in the 20th century it was difficult to belong. Irene Kelleher became a teacher and taught Dukhobor children a more difficult part of her life, as you'll read in the book, published by Caitlin Press. Jean Barman received the 2004 Lieutenant Governor's Medal for Historical Writing for her book, Sojourning Sisters. She is Professor Emerita at the University of British Columbia's Department of Educational Studies. She is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and the recipient of the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal. She holds graduate degrees from Harvard, Berkeley, and the University of British Columbia. Her book, Stanley Park's Secret, which she was first on the program with in 2005, was also a critically acclaimed hit that I see cited regularly so many years later. You'll find, like I did, Professor Barman's thoughts on how Ms. Kelleher was viewed in her lifetime and how we are confounded by the coronavirus and the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly interesting and timely. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Jean Barman. Professor Barman, good morning.
Good morning. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. When did you first meet Irene Kelleher?
I met Irene at beginning of the 1990s through a woman I knew because she had talked to me about research on her family, who phoned me one day and said, you know, I know someone who you should talk to because you're interested in the whole larger issue of Indigenous women, non-Indigenous men, and the role that they played in the history of British Columbia. And she gave me Irene's phone number. I phoned Irene, and Irene told me, oh, yes, I don't know, I'll phone you back. And she phoned me back in a week or so, and I assumed it was because she was busy and other things to do, but it turned out she'd been checking up on me. In retirement, she'd taken a course at the then College of the Fraser Valley, now the University of the Fraser Valley, on first thing she studied as a course was a history of Indigenous people in British Columbia. So she'd phoned the instructor and said, was I safe, as she told me. And he had said that, yes, I was safe. And so by the time I phoned back, she was pleased to chat, and we then did so over a course of a number of years.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about her life story is that it's also the story of her families.
Yes.
And her grandparents, obviously, from the 19th century through to her parents in the late 19th century through to, I guess, mid-20th century.
Yeah, that's when they died.
Yeah, and then hers, you know, touches the 21st century.
Right. So she's three generations that literally crosses, because when she died, she was very old, which was beginning of the 21st century. So it does, yes, it does cross, and it's a family which has kept very much aware of their family history, I think, and they've kept in touch with each other, which often doesn't happen, as you know, in families that start out somewhere else in the world and then end up in British Columbia.
Yeah. By the way, do you get that a lot, but people say to you, I know someone you should talk to?
Yes, it happens. It happens from time to time, or people will email me or phone me up to talk about their family history. The first, with this book, the first response it generated, which was after it had been released, was somebody phoning me up and said that she knew that one of the members of her family was Japanese and one was indigenous, and this was the first time she'd ever dared to think about the possibility that their lives had meaning and who they were. I didn't hear from her again. It was one email, and I said, yes, you just, you know, you must find out because it's important. These are your, it's your family, and it's British Columbia's family.
Yeah. I mean, are you asked a lot about Irene's story and why it's important?
Well, I thought it was important. I mean, I talked to Irene in the 1990s. She died at the beginning in 2001, I think, 2002. And I didn't do anything with it immediately, in part because I kept trying to keep in mind what Irene wanted in the course of our conversations, all of which I took notes of and she read through later on, so they were very much in the... There's nothing private about them, which was only Irene and me, although at the time I just did that so that Irene was comfortable when we talked.
Mm-hmm.
But Irene wanted the story told. She was very concerned, but she didn't want the story told right at the point when we were talking, which is why it, you know, sat for a while in my head and in my notes.
Yeah. When you take the book on the whole, it's also a marvelous view into what life was like in the Fraser Valley.
Yes.
Through those three generations. Was that a common sort of lifestyle where one worked the land as the Kelleher's did?
I think Irene's story is very much, it's British Columbia's story in the sense that these are two men who came to British Columbia because of the gold rush. I have a book contract to do a book on the meaning of the British Columbia gold rush, which I think nobody has yet quite figured out, or at least not in the way I think it mattered, uh-huh. in the sense that if there hadn't been a gold rush, there'd be no British Columbia. It would be Britain, since for about the last dozen years, had British Columbia after dividing up the Pacific Northwest with the United States. But it had nothing, it didn't do anything with it. It had Vancouver Island was where the Hudson's Bay Company, the fur trade, which was the previous only sort of non-indigenous element in the Pacific Northwest, where they hunkered down after the boundary was agreed between Canada, or between Britain, wasn't Canada then, Britain, and the United States in the 1840s, and they got permission to move their, move themselves and move the people working for them to Vancouver Island, which they did, and that became a colony, British colony, but there was no interest in the mainland whatsoever. It was an indigenous place, apart from the remnants of, you know, a few fur trade posts that had been there for a long time. And if it wasn't for the fur trade, I honestly believe that the Americans who wanted it, because you have to remember that the Americans had the entire West Coast
uh-huh.
up to British Columbia, and they wanted another part of it.
Yeah.
And Britain, particularly when the Civil War, after the Civil War, Britain allowed the South to build ships on its territory, and after the United States won the Civil War against the South, it wanted reparations for Britain having done so, and it offered to take British Columbia as mm-hmm. reparations. And if it hadn't been what happened a decade earlier in terms of the gold rush, they would have gotten it.
Yeah.
And then the United States would buy Alaska a handful of years later, and they would have had the American West Coast from the border with Mexico through the entirety of the West Coast. And so I think gold miners really matter. And Irene's two grandfathers both came because of the gold rush, as did many, many thousands of people almost fully men from 1858 onwards.
Uh-huh.
And so I think their story is important because it shows how men came for the gold rush, a lot then left when they didn't get the riches they wanted. But those who stayed made interesting decisions, made decisions on their own, out of their own will, their own vontade, which is a Sorry, my husband's historian of Brazil, so I ended up with Portuguese words, but it's their own sort of will. It's a better word than in English, as to what they would do with their lives. And hence, Irene is the granddaughter of those decisions.
Yeah, and so let's talk about those two guys for just a sec here. Some of the decisions which are talked about in the book are who they choose to marry,
right?
And their choices were those common ones.
Yes, because we're talking about this time period again, the 1850s, the middle of the 19th century, in the gold rush. There weren't many choices because all that existed in what is today British Columbia was the remnants of the fur trade, and these were men who, if they were going to have families in the first generation, they almost always had them with indigenous women, apart from a tiny, tiny handful at the very top. And then those daughters and sons then made their own way in the Pacific Northwest. And this was a very limited pool for relationships, an extraordinarily limited pool. And so for men who stayed, most of the men who came as gold miners, you know, they either got very rich and they left, or they stayed very poor and they left, but they didn't stay. But a large number, enough of them stayed. So, in fact, these relationships were almost always with indigenous women, or possibly with the daughters of earlier relationships that had been forged in the fur trade.
And what struck me as I was reading the book as well was just how much detail there was. I mean, there are obviously oral histories, diaries, and the sort that Irene had kept, you know, through these generations. I mean, as a historian, that must have been just fascinating and useful in the end to write a book like this, were they?
Oh, exactly. You know, what happened is that her parents, her grandparents, were open. Some families have hidden the secrets of both of her. Both of Irene's parents, they talked to people who wanted to talk to them. The CBC interviewed them extensively.
Right.
And Irene was then teaching nearby, and she remembered how, in fact, you know, they would come, the guy who was in charge would come, he'd be invited for supper or invited for lunch, and then they would sit and talk with him, and he tape recorded it. These interviews are in the provincial archives, and they're, you know, publicly accessible. Plus, they talked to other people who wanted to talk, because they... A number of families in similar situations have kept their stories private, and some of them still keep their stories private to the present day as to what their inheritance are. But both of Irene's parents, her mother and her father, were proud of who they were.
Uh-huh.
And Irene was proud of who she was. What kept her story from becoming generally known, it was known within, was the racism. I mean, she was a woman, so she was doubly a victim of the notion which came into the world in sort of the middle of the 19th century that race mattered, that color mattered, that physical features mattered, and in particularly the growing sense that in North America, in Canada, in British Columbia, that Indigenous people really didn't much matter. They were expendable, and that was, you know, very much the case in the United States, less so in British Columbia, but it meant that combination of non-white descent and Indigenous descent and racism, all of those things together, it was formidable. It's formidable for, you know, thousands upon thousands of people in British Columbia who have been in the same situation, were historically in the same situation. And so the choice is either you hide your inheritance, which people have done, or you, in fact, live with the consequences, which is what Irene did.
But by the way, you mentioned these Imbert Orchard tapes.
Imbert Orchard, yes.
Yeah, of her parents. Do you hear any of those?
I was talking about the Imbert Orchard.
Yeah.
And all of those exist, and a lot of those have, also come, some of them have come into printed form as well.
Right, yeah.
So Imbert Orchard didn't interview just Irene's parents. He interviewed people across British Columbia. You can buy the tapes from the provincial archives if you want, or you can get them. I mean, people have used them. I mean, many, many books have been done on them, because he was actually a very astute interviewer.
Yeah. What? So did you hear the tapes, though, of Irene's parents?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have the tapes of Irene's parents. I heard them.
Yeah.
They've also been transcribed, which a number of the tapes were transcribed in the provincial archives. And so, yes, as well. There were four or five other people who also talked to Irene's parents at different points in time, and some of this is published. It's all in the... I was a professional librarian before I was a historian, so it's all neatly in the back of the book.
Oh, yeah.
After what the sources are.
Yeah. What did they sound like?
They just sound like real people.
Yeah.
You know, people who are talking. I mean, you can look at all of the tapes that Imbert Orchard did over time, and what you get regional accents. You get accents which sometimes come because people come from other countries of the world.
Yeah.
And people do talk in different ways. And Imbert Orchard, we're digressing a bit, but this is really important for anyone who's interested in British Columbia history, is that he had this capacity to let people tell the story they wanted to story. He was directional, but he wasn't directional in the sense that that was exclusive as to what he wanted to know. So they're good.
Yeah. What did you find there was a historian sort of gaps or things that Irene didn't want to talk about that perhaps you wanted to pursue but couldn't because she might have obscured some part of her past or records even?
Well, if you look at the book, I mean, I was consciously with this trying to write about her story the way that she was comfortable having her story told. And she was comfortable by the time we, over the course of the 1990s, the time that we knew each other, and I say this in the book, I mean, repeatedly she says, you have to tell what we told you. You have to tell what I told you. And she was very open about what she wanted told. And it was a family where the usual kinds of situations happen. One part of her family was, you know, more respectable than the other part, and she talks about, you know, she talks about her uncle, you know, our uncle, how he, you know, he did this or he did that. But it was a very, in a sense, it's a good example of a family at that period in time in British Columbia, you know, going from the middle of the 19th century in the gold rush, now, you know, over 150 years ago, 160 yeah. years ago, up through the beginning of middle of the 20th century.
You also provide us a sense of the social interactions
right.
that Irene herself encounters yeah. in her time. The racism that obviously prevented her, I guess, from talking about or being open about it until much later. How prevalent was that? I mean, was that something that she felt, like, you know, going through her life as a teacher, walking down the street even?
Yeah, well, even when we were, I mean, I think I make a note of this in the book. I mean, even when we would walk down the street, she met a lot of former students and parents of former students, and they embraced her when she would meet them. But she would also say, if someone just looked at her, she'd, you know, who do you think that person is? Do you think he or she thinks that I'm an Indian?
Mm.
That never escaped her mind as to how she might be dealt with in any kind of social setting. But when she was retired, she'd been allowed back to teach in the Fraser Valley. I mean, she was essentially forced into the edges of the edge for a long time because mm-hmm. she was a teacher. She needed all of the time she was a teacher. She was helping to support her families with her salary. She had no option but to continue to teach. She did have a sort of, essentially, a breakdown. I mean, she just couldn't deal with it and took 1 year off. That was when she was teaching Dukhobor children, which was extraordinarily difficult. But Irene had no choice but to teach. She had, and she was interacting with family. She was interacting with children all of this time in her life. But when I knew her, when she was, you know, retired from teaching, comfortably retired from teaching, and as you see the picture in the book, she was acceptable within within her home community by that time.
Yeah.
It didn't leave her. It did. You know, it was still there in terms of all of a sudden it would come out if we were walking. There were other people there. She told me this anecdote, which is in the book. We were stopped for lunch, and they had pizza on the menu. And she said, "Well, I can't have pizza because I won't know what to do with it, and I'm sure somebody will look at me if I if I don't finish it up."
Yeah.
This is not just Irene. If I thought this was only Irene, one human being, you know, there would have been no, you know, we would have had a nice same relationship, but nothing would have ensued from it. But it was a case of a woman who wanted the story to come out eventually because she felt very strongly that other people should be aware of what was happening in the world, how the world worked in the sense of how these relationships of a combination of gender and race, how they worked out, how they'd worked out in her life, although she'd never let it, apart from that one year she took off from teaching, she had never let it consume her.
Yeah.
But she was very, she was an incredibly intelligent woman. She was a very bright woman, and she was aware. And she's not, I mean, what's important, and I think why I wanted the book to be published, and why people have responded to it in, you know, ways which are very heartwarming for Irene, if she knew,
yeah.
Maybe she knows, who knows, is that it's not just Irene's story. It's a story of, as the book was titled, Invisible Generations,
mm-hmm.
which have been an important part of who we are as a province and who we are as a country. You have example. Irene's parents worked. Irene's mother worked as a dressmaker all of her life for people who, you know, who wanted clothing made to help support the family. Her father was one of the main people in diking when the Fraser River exceeded its banks.
Uh-huh.
And so these were people who made those kinds of contributions as well, which we should commend. That didn't stop them doing that, even though, I can't speak for them because I can only know what they said to, they said to other people. But I think that it hasn't left British Columbia as an element of its way of being.
Yeah, and I think we kid ourselves if we try to forget that sort of prejudice that did exist, right?
It did exist. It still exists.
Right.
And again, because of what I do and the articles and the books I've written, I've been privileged to have contact with a lot of people who are descendants of one kind of form of discrimination or the other, and it may not publicly exist, but it's still there. It's inside of people. It's inside of Irene. It was part of who she were. I mean, it causes me to think of, what was there in my background as a child and a young adult that I have never, I have outwardly let go of it, but I have never really let go of those prejudices.
Or come to terms with it,
We all live with. We all live with some or the other. I mean, can I say one other thing?
Sure, sure.
I mean, I was thinking about Irene and the book, and Irene as I usually do, and I realized how close the present really, incredible, difficult situation with the coronavirus is,
uh-huh.
in the sense that we're supposed to have social distancing, six yards, 6 feet from each other. And we're supposed to continue to wash our hands, not have contact with other people outside of our family. And that was Irene's life.
Mm.
I realized that. Why is it that I haven't been surprised by all of these restrictions? Because these are the restrictions that Irene took as a given, that she had to keep herself at a distance from other people because she didn't know what they were going to, whether they were going to turn on her, what was going to happen, what the kind of prejudice would be. She considered would be, so distancing.
Yeah.
The whole notion of distancing is something that's very, it's got really strong historical roots in how some people in a society have lived, and it's not just Irene; it's people of non-white people, particularly
uh-huh.
indigenous people, into the present day and historically. I mean, they've lived with that same sense of how do I protect myself from what there is out there that might do me harm, as everybody is doing at the present day, in the fear of the coronavirus.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the Duke Awards a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people might not remember their part in British Columbia history. You mentioned the challenges of teaching them, because I guess they were opposed to going to school, right?
Right. I mean, the Duke Awards originated as an ethnic group in Russia, and they immigrated into the prairies, particularly in Saskatchewan, because of what was happening in Russia. They were discriminated against there. And then they were invited, or they invited themselves into British Columbia and came as a sort of collectivity with all of the kinds of assumptions they took for granted, in that they didn't believe, they lived collectively in large in large sort of you know, buildings would house a whole number of families. Were still, I mean, they were, and they moved into the Kootenays. And historically, I mean, for you know, for historians, some of the buildings are still there and it's part of our history. But they didn't believe in external forces, which meant that they didn't believe in public education. They were very, very opposed to public education and refused to send their children. And the provincial government was just as concerned that they should be schooled. And so they had, you know, tried to compel them to go to school. And one of the ways in which Dukhobor families resisted was they would burn down the school buildings.
Mm-hmm.
The time Irene, it was through a family, acquaintance of her father that she got interested and encouraged to take two summer sessions at the University of Victoria to learn to how do you deal with the situation in, you know, with Dukhobor families. But she ended up, the special accommodations they made for teachers were meant to protect them. But one of the ones she was living in was burnt down, and she survived.
Yeah.
But it was a very, it was an extraordinarily difficult, the story of the Dukhobors is an important story that has not been as much known as it should be, but it's another example of people who, you know, very much part of British Columbia, but
yeah,
wanted to live differently, and how much, you know, how much is a dominant society willing to let people live differently than themselves, which is, yeah, you know, an ongoing concern.
Yeah,
a lot of people have in British Columbia.
These threads of different parts of BC society intersect with her life. It's fascinating to consider. Another person that is mentioned in the book is Bernice Girard.
Right.
I mean, I saw her growing up on TV, flipping channels, you know, as an evangelist. Before that,
right,
she was well known in Vancouver as an alderman back in the day.
Yeah.
How did she? Who in the family did she interact with the most?
Well, Irene, a very close friend of Irene's mother, was a woman who was the daughter of a British Columbia provincial politician. And he had a family first with an Indigenous woman. Then he moved on in his life. There are a whole number of provincial politicians at this point who fit this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Then he moved on and found a white woman, and you somehow dispensed with your Indigenous family, and he dispensed with his Indigenous daughter, who was sent to the same residential school in the Fraser Valley as Irene's parents went to. Irene's father was an orphan, and he grew up in the residential school.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother just went there off and on as a day student. But Irene's mother became a very good friend of hers. She was a woman who I know about because her daughter, it's a complicated story, but the woman that she raised, who was her granddaughter, she kept all of the this woman's stories, her papers.
Yeah.
And because of my connection with Irene, Irene invited her over, and she gave me access to all of these records. And part of that story is in the book, because she was a woman who knew her background. She knew that she was important. She knew that her father was important, and she never quit loving her father, although he essentially abandoned her. But she also, after she married locally, in order to make a living, one of the things they do is they took in children who needed care, and that was part of her her concern for other people who had been in the same situation she was. And one of the people they took in for the summer was a child who had very difficult circumstances, who was Bernice Girard, who then went on to be a well-known minister. She was the first woman member of Vancouver City Council. She never lost her connection with this period in her life. And when her biography was written, it still is talked about. She talks about how she lived with this Indian family, and they took her in so she could be a little Indian girl like they were, which is an overstatement by a lot, in the sense that the family that she was living with was a woman who knew, you know, she knew she was a daughter of a provincial politician. She knew she mattered. She was family. Her husband was part Indigenous. But she embroidered it a bit. Mm. But I think that Bernice Sherard must have been influenced by the time she spent with them. She spent some summers with them, and she lived with them for a time when she was a child.
Yeah. In the time that you knew Irene, did you talk to other members of the family? Are there many left, say, even today?
No, I didn't. I didn't talk to anyone else. Irene had a brother who had two children, and she had a... She did not have a close relationship with him, to put it diplomatically. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, so I was not, at the time I talked to her, I was concerned. She wanted her story told. She wanted to know how she, her story told, and it was her story. And I didn't move on to other members of the family, and I haven't done so. Because again, a lot of this, you know, I've written a lot about a whole lot of families, and I think part of it is that if, for all of us, there are parts of our lives that we want to keep private and parts that we want to reveal to others.
Sure.
And it should be our decisions to make rather than, you know, some academic pounding on our door and saying, you know, tell me, or, you know, I won't go away.
Yeah.
It's a hard, you know, it's always a hard call.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the reaction to this book. It's been out since the fall. What are some of the other interesting things that you've heard since the book's come out?
As authors, we're sort of, in some ways, we're the last one to know in these kinds of situations. But I've had people getting in touch with me, and as I've mentioned before, people talking about, yes, this is their own family, and sharing material that comes from that. I was invited to give a talk at the University of the Fraser Valley, and there were a number of people in the audience who, you know, had similar stories that they told me. You know, they told me very briefly in the course of being there over a period of a couple of hours. What's happening generally is that more and more people are willing to talk about who they are. They're interested in talking about who they are. And technology, the notion you go on the web, you can find out about yourself if you want. You can get your DNA tested if you want and find out for sure who you are if you think you are. And also, there are a lot more books. I mean, you know, books that, mine is just one small part of this this phenomenon which has happened in that our stories have value beyond ourselves, and people are realizing that our stories have value beyond ourselves and that we will be respected. And I think it's much more the case that we will be respected for who we are and what is our family history, as opposed to racism, the notion that only, you know, only white folk matter takes priority over you know, sharing our own stories about ourselves, because our stories are interesting. And British Columbia is pretended for a long time, from the top down, that it was a white place. It was a British place originally, and pretended it was a British place. But it was never a white place. It had, you know, who were some of the first gold miners who came? They were Chinese men who came from China, and they continued. They mined all their lives. They lived here. Some of them had families, and there were people from South Asia who came, Sikhs who came in great numbers at the beginning of the 20th century. There's always been a diversity of people in British Columbia, and that's, you know, hopefully part of what will rub off from this story is that our biology, our genetics, are less important than the kinds of ways in which we socialize with others. Whether we're accepted by everybody or accepted within our own social grouping, all of this matters. I mean, you know, this is about all of us, and this is about all of us as to how we opt or don't opt to share. You know, we don't opt to share our stories or just talk to our neighbor next door about who we are, who we've been, how we got to British Columbia. Unless you're Indigenous, you know, somehow you had a family that came, or people that came from somewhere else to this place that we call British Columbia.
Invisible Generations came out in the fall, as I mentioned just the other day. Your newest arrived from another publisher, On the Cusp of Contact. That's out shortly, isn't it?
Yeah, that's out shortly, and that's actually appears. It's a very thick book. It appears because a woman in the English department, Marjorie Fee, a well-known scholar in her own right, decided that articles I'd written over a long period of time deserved to be seen and deserved to be read again. So the book has 16 articles that I've written over the course of, three decades, and the theme about them all is, and what I've been interested in, is this notion of, as the subtitle of the book is, gender, space, and race in the colonization of British Columbia, and the title is On the Cusp of Contact, because British Columbia is not that old a place, and however we come, as I've said a few minutes ago, unless we're indigenous, we come from somewhere else. And because of the long-standing dominance of males coming from elsewhere over females coming from elsewhere, partially because British Columbia is so hard to get to, there have been the history of British Columbia surviving and thriving because non-Indigenous men and Indigenous women created life together is a theme in the history of this province, which I think has been ignored. And to the extent that there's something that's, pushed me, compelled me, keeps me writing, and why, in fact, Irene's story was important. Part of it was I liked Irene. Whatever her story had been, I would probably have spent as much time with her as, just because she was an interesting person, and I was an academic who got bored with being an academic every day of the week, and she was a pleasure every two or three weeks to drive out there and spend a day with her. But it's important, the whole notion of who we are and how we got to where we are, I think, needs a broader look, and that's why I was very pleased when Marjorie C. initiated this project without letting me know she was doing it until it was too late for me to say this is silly, go away.
I'll look forward to reading that, and then and hopefully in a couple weeks or so talk to you about that book. But until then,
I'm grateful for your time. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I'll urge people listening to us to pick up Invisible Generations because, as you just said, Irene is an extremely likable person. And it's a great story to read about her family.
And that's the final last point. Is that's why the title of the book is a picture of her in retirement, which she was finally accepted in a women's group in the Fraser Valley where she lived. And I think she was. All of those things we talk about in terms of her character was absolutely there. And that was why it is annoying. It is annoying that this is that life has been like this for so many people.
Yeah. Thanks for this, Jean.
Well, thanks for you. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
The book is called Invisible Generations, Living Between Indigenous and White in the Fraser Valley. It is published by Caitlin Press. Its author, Jean Barman, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.